This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kaveh Tahvayi. Our guest today is Rabbi David Miviser. Rabbi David Miviser is a prominent American-Canadian figure known for his strong involvement in things like social justice, religious leadership, and political activism. And he also has been described to have become a lifeline for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and who has committed himself to work towards justice, equality, and the freedom of the Palestinians. And he joins us now. Rabbi David Miviser, welcome to Unscripted.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. Let me first start by digging in a little bit in your bio to bring some awareness with our audience about who you are. I'm looking at things like how you lived in occupied Palestine. You studied at a Hebrew university from what our research said, and you found yourself drawn to what was called Reform Judaism. Maybe you can explain that. And a quote that I have from you: I thought Judaism could contribute to fixing the world. And I picked that because we're seeing what's happening in occupied Palestine, but in particular in the Gaza Strip, and how that equates to the harsh reality that we're seeing right now.
Right. Everything you just said is true. You just gave me such a big sweep. It's hard to know where to come in and what you'd like me to talk about. But I did live in, it's interesting, you said occupied Palestine, and I don't argue with that. It is occupied Palestine. But for me, I was living in Israel, right? I was a young Jewish person, kind of discovering my Jewish identity and trying to shape my own identity. Who am I? And hearing about Israel was really important to me, and I wanted to go see it and be there. So I just, in my own perception, I was living in Israel, of course. At the same time, I was very much living in occupied Palestine, but I don't think I saw it that way. And just in terms of my biography, I lived there when I was 19 and 20 years old, 21, 22, I lived there, and I went back again, and I lived there for 4 different years. And I don't know if you or others here have seen the movie called Israelism, but one of the things that someone in Israelism said is, when I went there, I went to Israel, but when I left from Palestine. Hmm. And obviously they're talking about the shift in their own perception and understanding. So I would also say that about me, except it took me about 40 or 50 years to go through that transition, to reevaluate the I want to say the kind of romantic fantasy that I had as a much younger person, and be able to really integrate into my understanding what I think is much more kind of objective reality, that in fact it is occupied Palestine.
Sure. Well, let me come in, since you talked about the years that you spent there in occupied Palestine. I'm going to go back to your sophomore year at college. And again, this is the research we've done. This is what I came up with, where I thought it was interesting, where you said you saw Palestinian land expropriated, ethnic discrimination laid bare, and you had one memory where you said that the Israeli police, or we call it regime forces, refusing to help a young Palestinian boy who had cut himself on a glass and was bleeding on the sidewalk. And in reference to the transition that you made, I'm sure that this played part of it, it contributed to that, but I'm sure it didn't happen right away, where you saw what I just mentioned and you said, well, that's it, then I understand the whole thing, right?
Absolutely right. That incident, I'll just repeat it for people that haven't heard. I mean, this is just my own story. Again, I was 19 years old. I grew up in a very comfortable home in suburban Baltimore in the U.S. in a family that was all Jewish, but being Jewish wasn't very important in my family. And as I was growing up, that became really important to me. I think as I was trying to define myself, right? So I wanted to go see Israel and be there. Maybe the second or third day that I was in Jerusalem, I was walking down a very popular old shopping district street, and there was a boy, maybe 6 or 7 years old, holding his hand and crying, and I could see blood dripping off his hand. So I went to him, and I saw what was going on, and there were two policemen. And I took him to the policeman, and I said, help this boy. And they said to me, what? You know, he's an Arab. He's an Arab. Get rid of him. And I was shocked. I'm still shocked. But what you just said is so true. That did not change my understanding of Israel or what was going on there. That was like a fact that went into my mind. Obviously, I still remember it today, more than 50 years later. I saw many things like that again and again and again and again. I just want to say another one. I was a teacher in two small Jewish villages near the city of Tiberias, or Tabaria. Tiberias is an ancient city. It was founded by the Romans. And in the center of the city, it was all rubble. It was piles of stone that had been cut and dressed. You could see these stones were parts of buildings. And in each village, there was a pile of stones outside the village. And I asked people, like, what are those stones? Why are they there? And people said, oh, that was the Arabs' houses. You know, we chased them out and we blew them up so they couldn't come back. And I'm like, what? What? You did that? But that did not change my understanding of the whole big picture. You know, you just said to me, I imagine that didn't change your ideas right away. So honestly, I'm not proud of this, but this is a real story about me. It took me 40 or 50 years before I could integrate into my understanding of the big picture the fact that, yes, let's say the Nakba, 750,000 or more Palestinians being driven out of their homes violently and their homes being destroyed. Like, I knew that was a fact, but I didn't integrate the fact into my own understanding of things. And I'm just, you know, there's a term of cognitive dissonance, which means when you kind of like, you know, two different things that conflict with each other, and in your brain, you just suppress one of them and hold on to the other one, right?
Sure.
And I think that's very common.
Of course, of course. Well,
that's I'm saying this as a way to say that people can change.
Of course, but
people
it takes
who are
a
very attached to something. They may not see beyond that, but they can. It's possible. And not to like give up hope on people changing their perceptions of things.
Well, people are made up of the experiences that they have and maybe things that they either hear or they read, like you did when you read The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine in a book by Ilan Pappe, which discussed the Nakba, or the catastrophe, as it's called in Arabic. Now, we know what that's all about, and you just mentioned it, and I'm glad you brought up that town where you said you saw all the stones, and that was in reference to how it was the homes of Palestinians. I'm not too sure if it goes way back to that era, but I'd like to fast forward the notion of a Nakba to what is happening in the Gaza Strip, because that is what comparison is being made, whether it's from the Israeli officials in terms of what they are intending, along with the support of the U.S. If you could expand on that more, whether you agree or disagree.
Oh, I absolutely agree. This is like, it's even worse than the Nakba. I mean, it's 2 million people, you know, being killed, their homes destroyed, everything being destroyed. And clearly, if there's any rationale to it beyond just pure sadism and hatred, the rationale is to get rid of them, to clear them out and take the space over. And that is how the state of Israel was founded in 1948.
So you think that that's what the intention is here, is that ultimately they want them all out, that anything else is just smokescreens, it's not going to happen?
Well, yes, and I think there's something deeper than any rationale, no matter how sick and evil the rationale is, but I think there's something deeper in the psyche, which is just inflict suffering on these people, make them suffer. If Israel wanted to get them out, then why did they close all the borders? You know, Israel has such influence over Egypt. Israel could just kick open the border at Rafah and let people out, right? Let it be Egypt's problem. So there's something beyond that that's going on.
What
even
do you
like
think
I
that
reference
is?
Myself, like my own inner psychology and my emotional makeup and all that kind of stuff prevented me from really seeing what was going on for 40 or 50 years, right? So there's a rationale, I think, of like, you know, the Israeli politicians saying, you know, we're going to take this over and we're going to get rid of all these baby terrorists, all this like sick, sick thinking. But deeper than that, there's some kind of emotional, psychological motivation for just inflicting suffering on these people. And I don't, you know, I think it comes from a very deep kind of psychological damage that comes from literally centuries of Jewish people being disempowered, being victimized, being expelled, you know, on a you know, not long before I was born, during the time when my parents were already adults, was the Holocaust, right? Mm-hmm. 6 million Jewish people killed and their homes destroyed and their entire communities destroyed. And even like my own grandfather left Russia because of pogroms. And that history not only is true, but it's something that gets focused on and gets talked about, and there are museums and there's education. So part of the psyche is, I'll just say it in a kind of crude way, they did that to us. And now that we have some power, we have the weapons, we're backed up by the US, we're gonna do it to them. It's not the same us and them. Like, that didn't happen to us, didn't happen to me, didn't happen to anybody really living today. It's vicarious. And the them that we're doing it to, they're not the people that did that to us,
right?
You know. But I'm just saying, I think if you go deeper than the political and the economic and things I'm calling rational, there's something else at play. I shouldn't say at play. There's something else that's motivating what's going on.
Well, that motivation that you are referring to couldn't happen were it not for the U.S. support in one form or another, which basically the military aspect of it is very evident. Just in the past day where you had the U.S. President Donald Trump speaking, some of the things that he said there are, again, referencing to how he thinks Palestinians should be removed. He says they want Palestinians to have a chance at life. Gaza, this is Trump's language. Gaza is a hellhole. Hamas has made it so bad. This is what I'm recommending, which would bring peace. I mean, you know, when he says things like that, of course, it's Trump for you. But he says, give people a chance to live in a beautiful community, which is safe and secure. But do you think it was a concerted effort by the U.S. providing these 20,000 assault rifles that we understand that was delayed by Biden, or the delivery of 2,000-pound bombs to Israel to make sure that it's unlivable there so that he can now come out and say what he has said?
Again, I don't think that's the real motivation. I think the U.S. government is simply manipulated by the Zionist lobby. You know, the people in Congress and the people in the administration want to please the Zionists, who are among their largest funders. You're just referencing Trump, and then you mentioned Biden. If you look at the top funders of the Democratic Party, just take the top 10, probably 8 of them are Zionists. And I'm not using that as code language for Jewish. I mean, they're actually Zionists, right? So a lot of times what countries do, and of course what individual humans do, is not rational. They're not doing what's in their best interest or anyone else's. They're reacting kind of emotionally or reacting to other factors that they don't talk about. They may not even be aware of themselves. So everything you just quoted Trump as saying is completely false. I don't imagine Trump himself believes it. Trump is like a master showman and such a deceiver. So he says some words that he thinks might sound good, but that's not what's going on. And I don't think the U.S. intentionally has a policy to try to get rid of 2 million Palestinians out of Gaza. I don't imagine that's like the U.S.'s intention, but I think the U.S. is getting dragged along with some pretty fanatic extremist Zionists, like the tail wagging the dog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about another aspect when it comes to the Gaza Strip. And I'm going to look at this based on how you reference to Alex Lubomirski in your, this was in a tweet. He's the one that you said is the massacre franchise. I mean, that's what he said over the what I have over here, owing it to surprising success to the fact that in real life we do not subscribe to the ideas of rebels. This is what was said in the reference you made in that tweet. I don't know if you recall that, where he has said this. And he said that the rebels in this franchise are not the heroes. They are labeled as terrorists. Okay? And then he goes on to say, even the women and children are approved targets as potential uprisers and dealt with accordingly. He's referencing to the Hamas rebel fighters. What do you think about that? What is your view on how Hamas, the representation that it has for the Palestinians, specifically in the Gaza Strip, and of course for what they are after, in terms of the suppression and everything else that has happened to Palestinians, and how they have been, based on many, the flag bearer of that?
Hamas is like, I just have to find the right word. You're talking about the image of Hamas, or how Hamas is talked about. And you even just said that many people talk about, you know, women and children are just going to grow up and become terrorists. So it's obviously a distortion and a manipulation, and it's being used to justify like the worst atrocities and war crimes, crimes against humanity. Okay. But what you're bringing up is how Hamas has been so demonized in the West, especially by Israel, and it's, you know, it's, I can almost say like it's puppets. Like they make up stories about Hamas and then use that as an excuse for what they're doing to all the people of Gaza and even people in the rest of Palestine. You know, I mean, we know that what they've done in the last month, like say in Jenin or in Tulkarm, of you know, killing people and destroying their homes and displacing them. And Hamas is not even there, but they use the image of Hamas that they've created to justify what they're doing. I hope I addressed what you're asking.
No, you have. In some respects, you have. In other respects, you know, we are looking at the fact that Hamas is a resistance group, and the fact that they obviously have been standing up to the Israeli occupation, particularly when it comes to the Gaza Strip, because the picture that's painted by the Israeli regime in one respect is the fact that, oh, we left Gaza to the Palestinians, and look, Hamas came and took it over after we freed that area. Well, they never freed that area, did they? Maybe you can tell us about that.
Not at all. More than that, first of all, Hamas was elected by the people of all of the, I'd say, the Israeli-administered parts of Palestine, you know, the West Bank and Gaza. They voted, and Hamas won the election. No one disputes the validity of that election. There were international election observers, including even Jimmy Carter. So Hamas was elected, right? That's one thing everybody needs to remember. Israel did not free Gaza when Sharon withdrew the forces. The best analogy I've heard comes from an Israeli-American professor, or an actually American-Israeli named Jeff Halper. He said, it's as if in a prison, all the guards left the prison, but they kept the keys to the gates, right? So all the prisoners can leave their cells, but they can't get out of the prison. And the guards controlled what food goes in, and the guards controlled everything. So yeah, Israel withdrew from Gaza, but it was never, ever free. And Israel imposed its embargo on Gaza. So the people in Hamas lived in those conditions, you know, for 16 or 17 years with a complete embargo. But there's so much to this, you know, if people want to know, they can read and they can learn. And, you know, I referenced before how I have been learning through my life, and things that I learned do change how I see things. So I want to name a book. There's a book called, I think it's called Footnotes in Gaza by Joe Sacco. And Joe Sacco sees himself as a journalist whose style of reporting is graphic. So he draws what you could call comics, but he delivers so much factual history. And I read that, and it's about what Israel did in Gaza in 1956. Just killing people, hundreds of people, lining men up against walls and just shooting them dead.
Interesting.
And, you know, so that is in the background. And when we think of Hamas, and you talk about Hamas as resistance movement, you have to remember, where is that coming from? I want to put in another layer that needs to be said out loud. 80% of the people in Gaza are there only because they're the survivors of the Nakba 1948. They are the children and grandchildren, sometimes even the people themselves, who are driven out of their homes at gunpoint, people in their family killed. You know, they're the ones who managed to flee and survive, and they were pushed and stuffed into this place, which then later became the Gaza Strip. When Israel negotiated armistice lines after, you know, the Nakba, they actually cut off this piece of land where they stuffed all these survivors and said to Egypt, you administer this. There never was such a thing as the Gaza Strip. So I'm just saying, 80% of the people there, their parents and grandparents lived in places like Isdod, you know, Beersheba, Yaffa. I know many people whose grandparents are from Yaffa, right? So I'm saying that resistance is very legitimate. It happens that Hamas organized it, and you could say it's like the leadership, right? You have to hold it in that perspective.
hold on to the thought that you have on resistance and Hamas, because I'm going to come back to this, but in another way. But since you talked about Israeli officials, you know, I find it really interesting that when we look through the pages of history, you have many Israeli political and military leaders that have wondered, will Israel become an apartheid entity? That's one of the things that has been mentioned. And then, we, of course, during the tenure, they don't say anything to that effect. But after the tenure ends, we're looking at overall Mossad chief, former Mossad chiefs or former Shin Bet chiefs that have the courage to come out and actually say Israel exemplifies apartheid. I mean, I'm looking at, for example, how back in 1967, the former Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, who came out and said better rid itself of the territories and their Arab population as soon as possible. If it did not, Israel would soon become an apartheid entity. You know, so that's interesting. You have these leaders, Yitzhak Rabin also said something similar, that during the time, maybe they don't talk about it as much, but when they're out of office, they do mention that. What explanation do you give to that?
Whew. I think, again, you have to go to some kind of psychological, emotional level rather than something purely rational, you know, and people... First of all, people do change as they go through life. I think I'm a humble example of that. And then second, when people are invested in a project, like David Ben-Gurion being the Prime Minister of Israel, that is primary in their minds. And then when they're, you know, when they step back from it, they can look at it differently. I want to bring into this moment of the conversation, you may know that Moshe Dayan, who was like the commander of the Israeli forces, spoke at the funeral of an Israeli soldier who was killed, I think 1956. I think someone from Gaza crossed into the land that the Jews had captured, that they called Israel, and killed an Israeli soldier. And at his funeral, Moshe Dayan said, basically, he understood this, that the people in Gaza saw us take their homes. They see us farming their land. Of course, they want to get rid of us and they want to get it back. You know, they were aware of what they were doing. Moshe Dayan didn't then say, oh, so let's like reach an agreement with them and be fair to them and let them back. That's not the conclusion that he drew from it, right? His conclusion was, so we have to be strong and defend ourselves because they're always going to want to take back their land. But he's acknowledging what happened.
This is actually reflected in a poll that was taken, and I'd like to come to the poll results based on what you have talked about on Reform Judaism, which I'd like to get your thoughts on what that exactly is. But your quote, the quote that I have from you, I thought if more Jewish people understood Judaism that way and got involved with it in that way, that could really make a difference. Now, there's a joint poll conducted by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. And what it said, it covered the genocide in the Gaza Strip, and it said 66% selected committing genocide against Palestinians. That's according to this poll. And 27% believe the aim is to conquer the land and to expel the Jews, the most extreme of four options. Can you put that into context for us if you think that this poll is reflective of the sentiment that exists out there?
Well, I don't know enough about that poll to comment on it. But just to reflect a bit on my own life, when I was growing up, let's say in the 1960s, and then later in the 70s and the 80s, where I lived in the U.S., you asked about Reform Judaism, which was the largest, I believe still is, the largest Jewish denomination or the largest religious organization within Judaism was Reform. It was all about social justice. And my rabbis gave sermons about civil rights, supporting Dr. Martin Luther King, trying to change the social makeup of America. They gave sermons about peace and against the Vietnam War. They talked about stopping the nuclear arms race. You know, I was introduced to the whole issue about migrant farm workers and about racial justice in America and about slum lords, and so many things came to me through Reform Judaism in the name of the prophets, you know, quoting Isaiah and Micah and Jeremiah. This was my inspiration, and that was Judaism, right? At that time, it was really inspiring. It was compelling. Uh-huh. And now things are so different because the institutions of Judaism are so aligned with Zionism and with the state of Israel. I would say they've been occupied. You know, I want to bring that perspective. I don't know the specific survey you asked me about, but just to look at overall what has changed, say, the last 50 years, and how Judaism itself is manifesting very differently than it ever has before. It's a great distortion. It's a perversion. I would say it's not even really religion, much less really being Judaism, to see how Judaism's being used in our times.
Sure. Indeed. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. In some way, there's something you can do that will help someone. And I'll be honest, they might get killed tomorrow. You know, maybe I'll feed them today and they'll get hit by a bomb tomorrow. Well, at least I helped them today.
Very well. Well, we're going to have to end it there. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. But thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to have you, Rabbi David Miviser, the prominent American Canadian that I mentioned, obviously standing up to the description that I gave you in this program. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you.
And that brings us to an end for this interview with Rabbi David Miviser. It was a pleasure to have him and his thoughts given to us, especially the background that he had. And we hope that you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Kavitai Hawaii. Until the next Unscripted.
Why there is a need for a government which will be established by the Wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghibah.
Let us see how one can prepare for the advent of the zuhur of Imam Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Please stay tuned. The 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is the one who brings hope to all of humanity. As the world is being grinded between the oppressors and tyrants of the age, we look towards the heavens so that the advent of the 12th divinely appointed Imam comes sooner. We raise our hands in prayers and we raise our hands in supplications so that the awaited Savior of humanity comes and brings the final hope and salvation that humanity is so yearning for and desiring. The sights and the eyes of the world are looking towards the advent of this great Savior, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance so that his eminence comes to establish the divine rule of the Almighty Allah. For every single human being is completely dependent and needs this divine rule of the Almighty Allah. And it is this divine rule of the Almighty Allah, the kingdom of God that is to be established by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, which will bring about ultimate justice in a world which is filled with cruelty and injustice. welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Mahdi, the awaited savior of humanity. May Allah hasten his reappearance. So we are talking about these dialogues of Imam al-Mahdi, the awaited savior of humanity. Of course, Imam al-Mahdi has two occultations. One is the minor occultation, in which he has direct contact with his representatives. And we are now in the major occultation, of course, where Imam al-Mahdi does not have direct representatives that are in direct contact with him at the present age and time. But of course, this does not mean that His Eminence does not contact or does not have some sort of relationship with individuals that are very special and unique and are doing the work of Imam al-Mahdi in the present day. So there's a very beautiful conversation that takes place between Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and an individual by the name of Muhammad Asadi. And so in this conversation, Muhammad Asadi, he asks various questions from Imam al-Mahdi, and Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, he responds to these questions. There was a total of three questions. We already covered the first question on a previous episode, and so we move on to the second question. And so here, Imam al-Mahdi says that as for a question that you, Muhammad al-Asadi, asked about that which has become endowed about us and that which is fixed for us, but in spite of this, if its owner becomes needful of it, its reply is as follows. Till this endowment has not been accepted, a transaction is allowed to be made invalid, and one can then spend from that which originally they wanted to endow. But on the other hand, if it has been accepted, the endowment has been accepted, it cannot be made invalid because the transaction has been concluded, whether the individual is needful of that endowment or not. So a very interesting thing, you know, sometimes we think that the conversations or the issues that the divinely appointed imams dealt with were perhaps only mystical issues, spiritual issues, or these kind of moral and ethical issues. Now, unlike the other major Abrahamic religions on the earth, so for example, the Jewish faith, for example, we find that it is very heavy on law, but very rarely does it talk about the spiritual, ethical, moral type things as much as it does the law of the Almighty God. But on the other hand, Christianity, as in the present day, of course, they have abrogated the law, they have left the law, they believe that the law no longer applies and that all of the teachings, supposedly in their point of view, are limited to spiritual teachings. But Islam, on the other hand, is an all-encompassing religion. It deals both with the jurisprudential aspect as well as the spiritual, moral, and ethical aspect of life and of a human being. So truly, we find with this reply of Imam al-Mahdi that Islam is a complete and whole religion. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So, brothers and sisters, migration or hijra to the wilaya of God. We're going to be asking a very important question, one that applies. Can I, as a Muslim, live under the wilaya of the taghut? As a Muslim, once we've discovered what wilaya truly is it possible for me to live under the wilaya of the taghut. More precisely, is it possible for me as a Muslim to have embraced the wilaya of the taghut and still consider myself a practicing Muslim? Read the chapter. Is it possible? If that's not, then what is the solution? Inshallah, we're going to read the chapter together. But before that, we have to bring ourselves up to speed. Where are we in the book? What conclusions did we already come to? As always, brothers and sisters, we start with that dua. We're asking Allah for clarity. We're talking about aqidah, beliefs. We want clarity. We want to see the truth as truth. The Imam tells us this. He says, the dua, wa arinil haqqa haqqan. Oh Allah, show me the truth to be truth. Wa arinil haqqa haqqan hatta atabi'ahu, until I embrace it. Wa arinil batil batilan. Show me falsehood to be falsehood hatta ajtanibahu, so that I avoid it.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight. an Israeli man who claimed to have heroically rescued hundreds of people from the resistance movement Hamas fighters on October 7, 2023, has been exposed as an outright liar who made up stories from beginning to end. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, an Israeli man who claimed to have heroically rescued hundreds of people from the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas fighters on October 7, 2023, has been exposed as an outright liar who made up stories from beginning to end. The debunking of Rami Davidian's fabrications by high-profile mainstream Israeli journalists is highly significant. But it comes a year after the Electronic Intifada concluded from its own investigations that Davidian's self-aggrandizing accounts were replete with inconsistencies, impossibilities, and lies. Davidian, who was a star witness in Sheryl Sandberg's 7 October atrocity propaganda film Screams Before Silence, also claimed to have seen dozens of dead victims of alleged rapes. Raviv Drucker, a journalist with Israel's Channel 13, revealed that his network was set to air an expose of Davidian's lies in the coming days. The broadcast was, however, cancelled after a promo trailing the report caused a public backlash. Today, in the early afternoon, the CEO of Channel 13, Emiliano Kalesmuk, called and said that he decided not to broadcast the segment on Rami Davidian that was scheduled to be broadcast on Sunday, Drucker revealed recently in a post on Twitter. He added, this was the first time that we spoke on this topic. I told him that it would be a grave error. Clearly upset at the suppression of his team's work, Drucker went on to describe how meticulously the report was prepared and to characterize what it reveals about Davidian's claims. Drucker wrote, these are not slight exaggerations, mightily inflating the number of those rescued. Absolutely not. These are stories made up from beginning to end. Hair-raising stories that never ever occurred. Drucker notes that Davidian's claims of rescuing Israelis were quoted in a reputable film, in newspapers across the world, and in an important book. The Electronic Intifada had already exposed Davidian's lies almost a year ago when it debunked Screams Before Silence, luckily the reputable film to which Drucker refers. The Sandberg film was promoted as a documentary film on the sexual violence committed, but this writer exposed it as a total fraud on the Electronic Intifada live stream for May 1st, 2024. The Electronic Intifada also concluded from inconsistencies in his accounts that Davidian had fabricated a superhero-like account of rescuing an Israeli woman tied to a tree by Hamas fighters. You can watch the segments specific to Davidian in the video at the top of a page in the Electronic Intifada website. Ever since October 7, 2023, according to Channel 13th Drucker, Davidian has turned his stories into an industry, taking part in paid lecture tours in Israel and abroad, as well as fundraising campaigns. In perhaps hundreds of interviews, Drucker wrote, Davidian repeats over and over again stories that simply never happened. Davidian's debunked claims are also cited in a report by an all-party group of British lawmakers. The October 7 Parliamentary Commission report purports to meticulously document the grisly fates of 1,182 people killed. The parliamentary report cites Davidian's stories, as told to Sandberg, as part of its evidence giving his lies a veneer of official credibility. To date, there is no single positively identified victim, living or dead, of the alleged mass rapes on October 7, 2023. As the Electronic Intifada has reported since the early weeks of the genocide in Gaza, the Zionist regime's mass rape narrative is atrocity propaganda. It is rooted in racist stereotypes of colonized and subject peoples, similar to the routinely fabricated accusations of the rape of white women used for decades to justify the lynchings of black men across the United States of America. The handful of other eyewitnesses to October 7 rapes or crime scenes gave accounts that collapsed completely under scrutiny, and there was a major scandal after the New York Times published a notorious December 2023 article which contained multiple debunked claims of rape. Nor is Davidian the first grifter allegedly seeking money and fame from the mass rapes hoax, with Drucker's exposure of Davidian's lies only the latest about October 7 to be debunked. There is no excuse for Western media and politicians to keep parroting propaganda whose only purpose is to incite or attempt to justify the Zionist regime's genocide of the Palestinian people.
Thank you.